From our studios in Cuenca, Spain, I'm Kate Jetmore with The Listen, the podcast that encourages community, cross-cultural dialogue, and open conversation. Today, another interview in our Season 11 series focusing on the opioid crisis. We're talking about the importance of sharing our stories, finding a new appreciation for life, and looking to the future. My guest today, Nicole Powers, has a wonderful fiancé and four beautiful daughters. Add in her six grandsons, and it's clear her life is vibrant and full of love. She grew up in Richmond, Indiana, graduated from Richmond High School in 1989, and has a bachelor's degree in mass communications from the University of Evansville. She has been an administrative assistant at Central Indiana Transport Express in Richmond, Indiana, for the past 2 years. She feels super blessed to be alive and contributing. Nicole Powers, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
First of all, I want to share with our listeners how excited you were when I reached out to you about the possibility of coming on the show and telling your story. So why was that? Why are you so eager to do this interview?
Well, number one reason is because I feel like there's so many people that are suffering from this the opioid crisis right now, whether it's a loved one or it's the addict. And I just think it's important for people to know that recovery is possible.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And I think you know, a lot of people are really afraid, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
What do you think is the reason? Why aren't people talking about it?
I feel like people are still put so much of a stigma on addiction, you know, when in reality, addiction is just a disease like anything else. It's a mental illness. I just feel like people need to be more open to discussing the fact that, you know, the people that are addicts aren't just a waste of human life, you know, that they're somebody's child and somebody's mother and somebody's father, and, you know, that their life matters just as well as anybody else that has cancer or, you know, heart problems or depression or anxiety or anything. You know, I feel like it's important to that they feel included. And
it is important. And I so appreciate you being part of this conversation. I mean, no one can tell the story of what it's like to be there like someone who's been there. So, you know, before we actually get to the crux of your story, let's go back to the very beginning. Could you give us a sense of what your childhood was like, where you grew up, and what you were like as a kid?
Sure. I am a little bit nervous, so I'm going to tell you that. But I grew up in Richmond, Indiana, and I grew up with my mom and my stepdad and my brothers. My dad was still in the picture, even though that him and mom were divorced. And I loved music, singing, playing the piano, being in choir. I was a happy child, you know. I had a great childhood, a wonderful upbringing. But also, I also struggled with depression and self-esteem, which I think is fairly normal, unfortunately, for most teens. But I was adopted, too, so I sometimes, I don't think that really, it's doesn't bother me because I'm very fortunate, but I think at times I felt like maybe I was unwanted or, you know, unloved and that my, you know, that somebody had to choose to want me. And I think that some maybe might've played a little bit of a role in the depression and the anxiety that I was feeling.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned your love of music. You and I sang in choir together in high school, and I have so many great memories of, you know, performing on stage with you. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh,
and
me
I'm
too.
Also glad that you put words on, you know, having a struggle with anxiety and with depression. And I think that that's another stigma that people are really reticent to talk about. You know, I think that it's a much more I think there are much more people suffering from mental illness than we know.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
When did drugs enter your story? How did that happen?
Well, when I was a teenager, like I said, you know, I struggled with things and I dabbled in a little bit of marijuana and alcohol, and I would take the mini thins, you know, for a little bit of the speed. And I think that was more of, you know, when you're depressed, you have low energy. And I just found that when I was doing those things, I felt better about myself and I had more energy. And I don't know. I think that's mainly when it started. It wasn't like an everyday that I needed them. But when I had low points in my life, I found that I would turn more to drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana. And so I think that's where I kind of started a little bit of a groundwork for the addiction, you know. And I just feel like we were talking about with the mental illness, you're looking for something to make you feel better. And that's what I felt was making me feel better.
Right. And from what you're describing, I mean, I think a lot of people have engaged with substances, whether it's alcohol or whether it's marijuana, or I think a lot of people have used them, you know, to sort of self-medicate right. in the way that you're describing. But I think it's also fair to say that in your case, that's not where your story ended. So can you take us kind of farther down the path? When did things change for you, and how did they change?
Okay. Well, when I changed is I graduated from college in 1993 and I got married, and I had Emily, my oldest daughter. I have two older bonus daughters. But Emily, my oldest daughter, she was born. And then I got divorced and I was a single mother and I had a wonderful job. But it was at that point that I kind of started dabbling in pain pills and cocaine. I think I felt like, you know, my marriage had failed. My ex-husband he suffers from some mental illnesses of his own. I felt like I was trying to hold everything together, and I failed at that, even though it was a great step for me and Emily. As far as moving on with our lives, I was not feeling as confident about myself at that time. So that was really when I started dabbling in the harder drugs. Then I lost my job and I lost my place to live. And Emily and I moved back to Richmond, and we actually lived at this place called the Refuge of Hope that used to be opened by a wonderful couple. And we lived there for about 3 years, and that was the first time that I got clean.
Tell us about that facility. I mean, how would you describe it? You, living there for 3 years, that's a long time. So what exactly did that look like, and how many people were staying there?
Well, it was a big, huge brick house on 10th Street in Richmond. And it was owned by a couple of the Washingtons. And it was a faith-based recovery program. So my mom and my minister hooked me up with that. And so it was when I moved in, there were, I think, three other women there. It was just for women and kids. And it just, you know, we had classes every day, and we had Bible study. They'd help us with their legal issues. At that point, I had already gotten a DUI when Emily and I were living in Noblesville. So not a great place to get a DUI, but, I don't know. It was great. It was rough at first, but you know, I learned how to do things. They helped me learn how to take care of my child without drugs, and I learned how to get the resources that I needed, insurance and food And then eventually, as I got stronger, they helped me find a job. And then, and things were looking up and great, and we moved out, and I had, I had a job, and then things went downhill a few years later again. But
Okay, so it sounds like that was kind of the first, the end of a first chapter. And that's life, right? Life comes in waves. So it sounds like things wrapped up there and you were feeling hopeful and you were clean. Well, Nicole, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Nicole Powers. Back in a second. Listen is sponsored by RAF, cutting-edge cuisine in a traditional setting. For a look at the RAF dining experience, visit rafsanpedro.es. That's RAFFSANPEDRO.ES. This is Kate Jetmore with The Listen. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicole Powers, here today to share her story as a recovering addict and survivor. What can you share about what came next in your story? You shared before the break that you got clean, you and your daughter, with the help of several different people and a wonderful facility, were able to move out on your own. So, what came next for you, and what were your thoughts at that time?
Well, what came next for me was that I met Robert, my wonderful fiance, and I was still kind of a little bit, I had fallen kind of back into a little bit of the wild ways, smoking marijuana. I was doing a little cocaine, I guess, my first relapse when we met. And then we found out that we were pregnant, so I quit doing all of that. And we had Mary Jane, who is our youngest. And, things were going really well. Well, then I had started suffering from some pain in my shoulder when she was a baby. I couldn't really pick her up. So it's funny, is right before, like maybe a year before that, I had surgery. I was watching an interview about housewives that had become addicted to pain pills, and I thought how horrible that was, and what a horrible, knowing my past as an addict, what a horrible life that was to live. So I didn't go into surgery anticipating that I would be one of those people again. Unfortunately, with my addictive personality, once I had the surgery and found out how much the pain pills were giving me a false sense of energy, that was all it took. And I thought I was a great mom. I thought I was a better person. I had more motivation. Well, then fast forward, years down, four years down the road, and I'm addicted to the painkillers, and I can't stop, and that's just, you're so sick when you try to quit, and I wasn't ready. 2011, I was introduced to heroin, and something that I never dreamed in my life that I would ever say I was a heroin addict. That was not the way that I was raised. I know that sounds funny, but addiction does not discriminate. It doesn't matter if you grew up in a great family and had everything you wanted, or if you lived on the streets and had nothing. It will take you, anybody. But so at that point, I had been working for the family that I'd known since I was a kid for about 6 years, and I started stealing from them to support my addiction. And when, it was awful. I mean, I would do it, and I would be, what are you doing, Nicole? You know you're going to get in trouble if they find out, you're going to prison. And but then the addiction had such a grip on me, and I was so sick without it that but I felt like such a horrible person. I mean, I was a horrible mother. I was a horrible, I don't mean like beating my kids, but my words were, hurtful and hateful and just moody, and I was there, but I wasn't there, constantly chasing, my high and mommy got, I have to go, you know, no, you can't, you know, driving down the, pulling out of the driveway and my kids are standing there crying and I'm just leaving because I know I got to go get the drugs that I need. You know, it's just, it was just awful, awful. And then, the people that I work for, you know, they found out, it was the just the lowest point in my life. You know, I really wanted to die.
And what was it that they found out, Nicole? Did they find out about your addiction or did they find out you were stealing from them?
Oh, both. Well, honestly, you know, my coworker had asked me several times if she could help me because she knew clearly she could tell by the weight loss and the my mood and everything that there was an issue. And I told her, no, it was fine. You know, it wasn't a big deal. In my mind, I'm saying, oh, I'm fine. I've quit taking the pain pills. I'm okay. But in my mind going, oh, but I'm on heroin. Nobody knows. You know what I mean? So I've quit the pain pills, everybody. I know. It's just this sick mindset that you have. And it's just exhausting.
Well, and one thing that I heard you say, you know, several times in your description was that you just felt so awful that, you know, you were, not only were you going, you know, you were trying to feel better, but you were also trying not to feel sick.
Yes. Yes. And that is so hard. And I think that's one of the hardest things that addicts face, you know, because they want to get well, but in order to get well, you have to go through that. And it's just, it literally is pure hell. I mean, I wouldn't, I am so grateful every day to not be in that hell every day. And there would be moments where I would get up and I would look at Robert or I would look at my kids and I would say, you know, oh my God, I wish that I had the strength to have the energy to do the things that they do on a daily basis without having something in my system, you know. And it's, but in reality, they were doing no different than any normal human being should be able to do on a daily basis.
Right.
But,
right,
you know, when you're living in that hell, it's, and you've got a substance that's just taking over your body, you just, and your mind, you can't, it's hard to fight it.
Yeah.
Really hard to fight.
Well, at some point you did. I mean, you did reach a moment where things turned around.
Right.
What happened? What new element came into the mix to change where you were headed?
Well, I was doing financials. It was actually the end of the year, time for taxes. And I had been hiding bank statements and it just all came to a head. They found out, they confronted me. They came to Robert first actually and asked him if he knew. He had no idea. I had dropped the kids off at school and I came home from work. And he was home from work, and I thought that was kind of unusual. And he said, well, I just want you to know that I know what's going on. Everybody knows what you've been doing, and I love you, and I want to help you. And they pressed charges against me. They didn't want to, but, you know, they saved my life. And ultimately, I was sentenced to 4 years in prison for forgery, and I ended up serving about 20 months. And it was awful being away from my family, but it like I said, it was it literally saved my life.
How old were your kids at that point? You had two young daughters, and how old were they?
Well, Emily, I got locked up in 2013, so Emily was 11, and Mary Jane was 5 or 6. But it was just, you know, that put a lot of pressure on Emily because she's at home trying to be mom and sister and hold dad together and, you know, go through her own things that you go through at that age. And, you know, I remember when I first was in the Wayne County Jail, I called home and Emily, it was just like, Mom, how could you love your drugs more than you love us? And that was like huge for me, you know, because no mother wants to admit that they love something more than your child, you know, but at that point I did. And I know that's hard to understand, but I hope your listeners understand what I'm saying, that I clearly, I love my children, but addiction is so selfish. I mean, an addict is one of the most selfish people, and that's not because you want to be like that. I mean, I would hope that people that are suffering now don't want to be like that, you know, but it's just, you just are. And I don't know, it really, it was rough.
So take us back, Nicole. You turned yourself in. You said you ended up serving 20 months of a 4-year sentence. What does jail look like for an addict? I mean, you were actively using at that point, I think. So, I mean, is there any sort of, do they help you with detox, or do you just go through withdrawal on your own?
You know, honestly, I was fortunate because I did know that they would not, they don't help you with detox, unfortunately. So my family set me up to go. I went to Indianapolis to the Salvation Army for a week because I knew that I was going to turn myself in as soon as the warrant came out, because I wasn't going to put my kids through them seeing them, you know, come physically pick me up at the house or whatever. Mm-hmm. So my family paid for me to go to rehab for a week so that I could detox. And
before you turned yourself in?
Before I turned myself in. And I tell you what, seeing the women that were in there and having to detox in jail was just awful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm so grateful for that. But it's still, you know, even though I wasn't actively using the day that I went in, it was just, it's so devastating. It's such a horrible place to be, someplace I never want to be again. You know, to literally have all your rights stripped from you is just,
I can only imagine. I know now you call yourself a recovering addict. Is that what you call yourself?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, a recovering addict.
And what do your days look like now? I mean, could you just describe them for us?
Sure. Well, my days now, I work every day, Monday through Friday. I get up every day. I laugh. I love my family, my friends. My family loves me. it's for the first time in 50 years, I can say that I love myself. I love my personality. I won't, you know, apologize for who I am. But I'm also striving every day to be a better person. And I know there, you know, my daughters and I have open conversations about their feelings, you know, because they still have feelings that come up from, you know, old habits die hard, I guess, you know, promises and things like that. But, I don't know. I'm so grateful to be alive.
I can hear that. I can hear that in your voice. I can see it in your face. And, you know, leading up to this interview, you and I had, you know, several exchanges, kind of just, you know, scheduling when we were going to record and talking about deciding what exactly we were going to talk about. And it's so clear, how grateful you are and how, you know, how much you appreciate each day and each person. And it couldn't be more clear. Let's take another short break and we'll be right back to talk more with Nicole Powers. It is such a pleasure to share our interviews with you each week, and your feedback means the world to us. If you subscribe to our podcast and rate and review your favorite episodes, it helps widen our audience and bring more people into the fold. I'm also hoping you'll visit our website at thelistenpodcast.com, where you can let us know which episodes you're enjoying most and what you hope to hear in the future. You can find us on social media and check out the Listen blog, also available on our website. Once again, that's thelistenpodcast.com. We're talking today with Nicole Powers about her past addiction to opioids and her ongoing recovery. Nicole, before we go on, I wonder if there are any resources you care to share with our listeners who may need to reach out for help with addiction, whether for themselves or for a loved one.
Okay, well, as I said before, you know, your family and your minister can be very helpful. There's also Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous for the addict. And then you have Al-Anon, which is for the family members of the addict. And then there, you know, there are several addiction centers that are willing to help people too.
Okay. We will put some of those links up on our website, so people can access that, in the show notes. I'm curious, as you look back at the path you've walked, if you can share what you think worked for you and what didn't work as you were struggling towards sobriety.
Okay, sure. Well, I think the main thing for me is just being honest with my family about how I'm feeling, if I'm struggling or if I'm having a bad day, if I feel overwhelmed, I let them know. It's hard sometimes to tell somebody that you're struggling because they immediately go to that, oh my gosh, mom's going to relapse thing. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, I ask them to hold me accountable too. So if they see things that bother them or maybe take them back to feelings of before, to point that out to me. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, like my mom, couldn't really understand why I didn't want to sponsor and why I didn't attend meetings. And I remember when I was a few years into my recovery, she would always say, well, you really need to go to a meeting. And I'm like, well, you know, I understand that. And meetings are great. Sponsors are wonderful. But not every person has the same recovery program. I think that's important for people to remember. You can't run somebody's recovery for them. They have to find something that works for them. I just feel like as long as you have somebody that's supporting you that you can talk to about the struggles that you're having on a daily basis and that you don't keep up everything bottled inside, that's the main thing. You know, whether it's a minister or a friend or a loved one or, you know, in prayer, meditation, I just feel like, you know, you have to find something that works for you specifically, mm-hmm. and then just stick with mm-hmm. that.
It sounds like a big key in your experience was communication and making sure that you weren't isolating, you know, making sure that people are aware of what's going on with you, you know, instead of sort of holing up in your bed under the covers. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Absolutely. My mom would always say, I always knew something was going on with you when I didn't hear from you for a while. So that is, you've pegged that perfectly. Yeah, it's exactly right.
Okay. What do you wish you had access to as far as support or services? Was there anything there that you wish you had access to, but you didn't? And I wonder if you have any ideas for programs that could be put in place in the future, maybe that you've heard of in other places, okay. But they're not available in Indiana, for example.
Right. Well, I feel like, I think I had access to any resources that I could have had I chosen to do that. I think that's a huge thing is you have to at some point make a choice that you want a better life for yourself. I think the main thing that for me was just having the courage to ask for help. Clearly, at some point, it wasn't really the courage to admit that I had a problem because, you know, it was obvious that I had a problem. So I think that's the main thing for me. As far as programs, I feel like I would love to see more programs that don't involve drugs to... I don't know how to say that. I know there's a lot of the methadone clinics, mm-hmm. and although they've probably helped many people, I feel like that's kind of trading one addiction for another. Mm-hmm. The people that I've known that have gone to those clinics they're on like this long-term plan, you know, when realistically I think it should be more, if you need to do that, it needs to be more of a short-term plan where I don't know. I hate saying something negative about that because somebody out there might really need that. But I feel like if you're going to go that route, you need to have a plan of, this is when I'm going to start. This is when I'm going to stop. These are my goals and be done with it.
Well, as you said, I mean, I think there is a pretty vigorous debate on this subject about what whether people who go on Suboxone, for example, should be on it for a limited amount of time or kind of, a maintenance dose for the rest of their lives. I also heard you say very clearly, everyone's path is different, and this is what has worked for me. So I really appreciate you talking about what has worked for you and acknowledging that it might not be what someone else needs. So I, again, I think that's a it's all about communicating and having the conversation. So I appreciate that. Nicole, is there any advice you care to offer for any listeners out there who are themselves struggling with addiction?
Yes, I think that you need to reach out. Reach out to somebody that you know loves you. No matter how horrible you think you are of a person that you are, or how bad your life is, there's somebody that loves you, and whether it be your mom, your dad, a friend, and just reach out. And if you don't feel like you have anybody, then find somebody to talk to. I think that you need to remember that you're worth it. You're worth more than the addiction, and that everybody deserves to have a wonderful life.
Yeah, those are great words, and I so appreciate them. And I'm so grateful to you, Nicole, for not only being willing to tell your story and come on the show, but being really excited to tell your story and say, listen, this is something that we all need to talk about, and I can help by saying what my experience has been. So thank you so much for being that person. I really appreciate you coming on, and I wish you and your family all the best.
Thank you so much, Kate, and thank you for having me.
Next time on The Listen, we'll be joined by Emily Powers, the daughter of today's guest, Nicole Powers, who is eager to share the many human elements of her story growing up with a mother battling addiction. The Listen podcast is produced and recorded in Cuenca, Spain, where the original fortress was built by the Moors in the 8th century. If you enjoyed this interview, I encourage you to check out our full archive by becoming a subscriber or by visiting our website at thelistenpodcast.com. There are dozens of interviews waiting for you there, all free and easy to access. I want to thank our producer, Lauren Lovett, and EJ Jetmore, who handles our social media. And many thanks to Lucas Munoz Jetmore for editing the show, providing tech support, and writing our theme music. I'm Kate Jetmore, and this is The Listen.